Welcome to the Oxley Bond MotoGP podcast.
Everyone, it's the Oxley Bond MotoGP podcast with me, Matt Oxley, and my podcast partner, Peter, who doesn't need to introduce himself except say hi.
Peter Bond.
Because, I think you know who everyone. We are now. So here we go. So this is the weekend between the first race and the second race. So we had Qatar last weekend and we got Portimao next weekend. So very much looking forward to that. And just wanted to say a couple of things before we get into it. You know, we're doing stuff on Patreon now. So, you know, you can join us via oxleybond.com. Just go there on the Patreon page, and I think it costs £3.50 plus VAT per month. And we're going to be putting loads of stuff on Patreon. Our first proper Patreon thing has gone up last week, which is a 40-minute interview with Casey Stoner talking about how he rode the 990s, how he rode the 800s, how he rode the 1000s, you know, so basically how his style changed, how the bikes changed. And Casey's talking about that stuff is just fucking unreal. He's just so good at explaining. I mean, it's just, yeah, gives me shivers down the spine just thinking about it. You know, it's just so cool. You'll learn so much. So that's on Patreon. We've got other stuff coming up on Patreon. We've got Rossi interviews and so on that are going to go on there in the next couple of weeks. I'm going to, at Portimao, I've got an interview with the legend that is Carlo Pernat, the paddock bad boy, oldest man in the paddock and the baddest man in the paddock. So we're going to do a kind of sex, drugs and rock and roll interview with Carlo Pernat, all the kind of crazy stuff he's done over the last 34 years in the paddock. And we've got a top aerodynamicist who we've got coming on. He's just waiting to get the okay from his bosses that he's allowed to come on because it's all top secret stuff. We're going to have a chat with a top neurologist speaking about concussion and stuff, how we're going to deal with that sort of in the future. You know, obviously a lot of talk about that in rugby and Formula One and so on. So, you know, MotoGP needs to get on top of this, definitely. So, yeah, lots of stuff coming up on Patreon, oxleybond.com. Throw some money at us, please. Help keep us this thing going. Next, I'd just like to say one thing very quickly about Gary Taylor, who former Suzuki MotoGP team manager from the late 80s until the early 2000s, like 25 years or something like that. He was team manager of Suzuki, signed Kevin Schwantz, guided Kevin Schwantz to the title in 93, guided Kenny Roberts Jr. to the title in 2000. Lovely guy, very, very funny, very, very sharp. I mean, super, super sharp. And always had the last word. And he even had the last word at his funeral, so which was a couple of days ago. And I went to it down in Kent. And we all had to stand up in the service and sing Monty Python's Bright Side of Life, you know. Always look on the bright side of life. We had to sing the whole of that. And, you know, it was just Gary having the last laugh on us, basically. So that was, you know, very, very sad, but also quite funny. So, right, let's get into the meat of the pod. Qatar last week. So, you know, what we're trying to do is sort of analyze, we've been analyzing a bit what happened at Qatar and, you know, what it means going into the next races, not just Portimao, but for the season as a whole. And, you know, the one thing we learn, well, Peter, what is the one thing that we learn from Qatar?
That we need to be very careful by drawing too much conclusions, Matt. Well, the points are the points, and we have a championship situation, and we have people who have been above the expectations and definitely some teams and people below it. But at the same time, you can't draw many conclusions from, because that's a one-off track. That's such a special circumstances. When I was still working in the box, we used to say to each other, Qatar is nice, but you learn fucking all. You learn nothing, you know? The track is... You can get away thinking you found something really, really valuable, only to touch down in Jerez, go out and cry again, because Jerez is the total opposite. It's a small European track with different grip level, not stable grip level, ups and downs, crazy temperature changes over the day. That's another kettle of fish. So, yeah, the points are the same, but you don't learn a lot. So teams have been testing in Sepang forever. Then they went testing in Qatar, and the finest thing they could find in all these days was put on the grid. So we have very, very small difference between everybody. People who were on a long distance in lap times in Qatar have a real, real big problem. That is for sure. Like Yamaha and Honda, they're not suddenly going to be on the front rowing in Portimao just because we are back in Europe. But other than that, the distances, the difference between the teams and the riders will be bigger in Portimao, especially Portimao and on the first day, because that's the opposite. That's a roller coaster. That's Brands Hatch on steroids. So I remember that coming there the first time when it was literally everybody's first time. I think even the trucks could really, really get there. We have to cut some trees to get there, and they were still plumbing the toilets when we were building the box and so. And we were having a laugh after going around the track and saying, fuck, can you imagine coming here with a MotoGP? No way. And that's history. Now MotoGP is there, and it's a handful. It's a fucking handful. There is a reason Miguel Oliveira won the first one. That was just because his track, that track is so fucking funny and so different. You can make the difference as a rider there. By now, everybody has been testing enough. So it's not, if you come there as a rookie the first time on a MotoGP bike, one name springs to mind, it's a bit of an extra handful. For the other riders, it's just Friday, getting your shit sorted, getting over your fears, trying to understand what the bike's going to do, because that the bike will have some funny situations. It's nowhere around the rest of the world's racetrack where you have G-forces like you have coming after that hill where they usually do the jump on the inlap. The G-forces coming down there, put it on the right side close to the ripple trip, and then putting it on your knee. The G-forces are unbelievable. That if you're not used to it, and you can't get used to it, you will be scared and you will be slow and losing a lot. But you can get away a lot, because that's not where people crash. People crash just before that. They never crash there. But still, it scares the hell out of you. So you take a lot of time. And after that, you go up the hill, have no idea where you're going to, but you have to peel in and brake for no reason. All you see is the horizon, because when you see it, it's too late.
Yeah.
And that we can do the whole track. Actually, I'm going to do the whole track like that. Basically, this week we will put the extra content on it, like the track again. Yes, Portimao is a handful.
Yeah, later in the week. Don't go too early. I mean, that left-hander, you know, everyone knows the jump, you know, that sort of where they come out of they go over a jump and then that down a hill, a little bit like Paddock Bend at Brands Hatch, but in reverse, a left-hander. And yeah, when they go into that super fast left-hander, oh my God, I mean, I just hold my breath when I watch people go in there, you know, so I don't know what the riders are doing when they're going in there. They'll be holding their breath three times, you know. And what you said about a certain rookie, you know, I think you were talking about Pedro Acosta. So he had obviously an amazing race in Qatar. He made sure he made an impression. I think, you know, the fact that he went backwards, I actually don't think that bothered him at all. But, you know, I think what he wanted to do was go in there all guns blazing and make an impression during the first third of the race or whatever. And that's what he did. It just didn't matter that he faded, you know, because he's got time to learn. But he wanted to make an impression, which is exactly what Valentino Rossi did in his first two MotoGP races on the 500. You know, he was fast and up the front, and we were all going like, wow, you know, he crashed out of both of his first races, but not without making an impression. You know, he was up the front. He wasn't down in 10th and crashing. He was up the front and crashing. So you were like, right, this guy's got it.
Same story with Fabio Quartararo, when he started with Yamaha, his first MotoGP race in Qatar. He stole it on the grid. Had to start from the back of the grid.
Pit lane, yeah.
Toward the pit lane even. And his third and fourth lap were unbelievably fast. He was just forgetting all they told him about conserving the rear tire. I'm so angry that I stole it, and I will show them I can do a lap time. He did a lot of lap times in the beginning of the race, which would make most people very, very happy. We were just crying and laughing, say, okay, that's suicide. And it was, because he nearly didn't even make it till the finish with that rear tire. But one thing for sure, everybody was remembering his name, and he put himself on the list there.
Exactly.
With a reason, yes.
That's what you got to do. And obviously, yeah, so Acosta's got to be, and his team, but Trevathan and all the KTM people, GasGas people, will be just saying, okay, you did great at Qatar, but you'd had 2 days of testing there, so you knew the track, and it's not an easy track, but it's a kind of fairly straightforward track, isn't it? Where, like you say, you go to Portimao, wow, you know, that's gonna be a baptism by fire, riding a 300 horsepower motorbike around a roller coaster, you know?
Yeah, but the way he rides that bike, Matt, I was so happy to see him, his body position over the bike. He's riding the bike like not many people are riding it. Means, let's take the opposite. You come from Moto2, you go to MotoGP, and you try to do everything correct as it's supposed to be done, and start to build from there on. Well, if you do that in Portimao, you will just be very slow and scare yourself, and it will take forever. At some point, you will find some speed. But the way Acosta was riding in the tests in Sepang, testing Qatar, the race in Qatar, was already mastering the bike, forcing the bike to do things that it wasn't really planning to do. It didn't really want it, but he decided, we go fucking left now, and you turn. You know, his whole body position, the way he was on the handlebars, the way he was playing with the footpeg pressure. He's not perfect in it, far from it, but at least it's his style. And that's exactly what you need to do in Portimão. You have to be forceful, not waiting for the bike. If it wants to go left, then remember where it wants to go left and try to go left there the next lap. No. I decide we want to go left here, and whatever it takes, we go left. If you wait for the bike to turn by itself in Portimão, that's just way too late. You're just slow. You can't do that. So this gives me good hope. And he was brilliant there in Moto 3 and Moto 2. Unbelievably good he was there. So, yep. No pressure, Pedro, but we expect a lot.
Yeah, if he shines again in Portimão with no testing, wow, that'll be amazing. And kind of wanted to talk a little bit about KTM. We didn't really talk about them much last Sunday in Qatar, and wanted to talk a little bit about their aero, because obviously they're working with Red Bull Advanced Technologies, who do the Red Bull F1 aero, so they know what they're talking about. And we're going to post photos on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and everything, so you can, while you're listening to this, you can look at these photos. And they've done something really clever, which they first used at the Valencia test, but have kind of obviously perfected over the winter. You know, the Aprilia has a kind of fat lower fairing to get ground effects. You've got a big slab of the side of the fairing against the road.
It's the widest bike on the grid by far.
But what KTM have done, they've got like a double skin fairing, which is really clever. So it's a fat fairing, so that it goes against the road to give them lots of ground effect. But the outer part is just a sort of false skin, if you like. It sits about 6-7 centimeters proud of the fairing itself. So when you're out a corner, you've got a big load of fairing against the track, so you've got ground effect. But when it's up, all you've got, that bit of extra fairing, is like a blade, you know, it's standing prouder than, so it's not slowing the bike down. You've not got a fat fairing. It's a really clever thing. What do you think about that, Peter?
Well, we expect a lot more from this in the future, because what we heard about the new regulations about aero in 27 is that they will not say you cannot have this wing, but you can only have that wing, and they will say there will probably be a limit on the frontal area surface. Well, what you're just describing is a beautiful way of having still a relatively small frontal area, but when you want it, you have that downforce, and you want it in the corner. But these sort of ground effect downforce things, they come with a price, like many things in life. And the price is, when it works, it's beautiful. When it's not work, it can be awful. And when you expect it to work, and it works shortly, and it sucks the bike to the ground, and then it stops because there is elevation in the corner, there is certain radius, there is bumps, then it can really be nearly a dangerous thing. You can't get used to that like a rider. So what we saw in the preseason here in the test and in Qatar again is that, okay, Aprilia made that point, but that was all about ground effect. And we saw that Aprilia can do some beautiful races with it. Silverstone, Assen, some tracks where you have these long flowing corners where you can lose it a lot, but on others can be a nightmare. So you saw that teams went smaller on the pure ground effect and have this type of this, whatever you call it, this downwash ducts, have them smaller.
Yeah.
So have a combination of a downwash duct in the front of the lower part of the fairing and then ground effect style a little bit after it. But the ground effect idea is beautiful, because look at Aprilia. I made some pictures in Sepang from the back and the front, and it's the widest thing on the grid.
Yeah.
So thanks for the idea, but Adrian Newey and his team made it into something a little bit more practical. And now everybody's paying attention and copying that for sure while we speak.
I would be very surprised if everybody doesn't copy that, because it's like any good idea, when somebody does it, it's obvious, isn't it? But until somebody's done it, it's not obvious. You know, you go like, oh my God, that's so obvious. Why didn't anybody think of that before? But, you know, I think it's a very clever solution, and I would be very surprised if depending on KTM's result, if Aprilia and Ducati don't kind of, well, and the Japanese don't follow that in some way.
And especially Honda, Yamaha, they can bring more aero updates.
Yeah, exactly.
It will be like a test of, you really want something, guys, or you just say you want it, but you don't do the work. We see.
Yeah, and that's what the Japanese have got to do, is they've got to swallow their pride and copy. They have to. You know, if somebody's got some aero that works really well, you just got to copy it. You know, that's the way racing works. I mean,
in a week.
You know, and it's always been like that. You know, go back to the last 20 years of 500 racing. Everybody had a 500 V4 two-stroke. You know, I mean, everybody copied each other, basically. That's just the way racing works. So KTM. Yeah, Brad Binder was sort of saying something, because I remember earlier in the weekend that KTM was saying that the bike was working really well. The place where you really make the difference in MotoGP now is not straight line braking, but braking on angle into the corner, especially with the rear tire, because you can't do that with the front tire because it's not good enough. So you're using that rear tire when you're banking into the corner, you're standing on the rear brake, you're using the engine braking to keep slowing the bike to the apex, and then hopefully to help turn you around the apex as well. But then Brad Binder said kind of the complete opposite after the race on Sunday, didn't he, Peter?
Well, he said something that really made me wonder twice or triple. He said, I couldn't use the rear brake. Or he said something like, and since we can't use the rear brake, and I'm like, oh, what you just said? Since we can't use the rear brake, that sounds like an engineer says, I put something really clever in your computer. One thing, forget about the rear brake from now on. That doesn't make a lot of sense. The rear brake is supposed to be that extra tool where you can use your talent if you have it, and if you still have the right angle, ankle. And so on and so on. So how are you going to tell your rider not to use it? A little research left and right and connecting some dots leads me to the assumption. Listen carefully, it's an assumption. I think they brought something that helps them on with the rear tire following the bike and decelerating the bike with angle, going that last couple of meters just before you put your knee on the ground, having the rear really solid there like an anchor and dragging you, bringing you easier to the apex. Maybe they found something there with engine brakes, setting stiffness, blah, 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 but it had probably a downside. And that down, I mean, if you have a good bike, Matt, everything you improve comes with a price. And you just have to look, to do the calculation, and below the line, there has to be a plus or a min, or you forget about it, or you keep it.
Yeah.
And there probably was a small, there was a plus under the line, so they kept it, but the downside must have almost been creating chatter.
Yeah.
And I think that because I had it once in the Moto2 time with Stefan Bradl, that there was some rear tire that worked quite well, but like many tires that work unsuspectedly good, it gave chatter, especially when it wasn't new. After 2, 3, 4 laps, it just started to get worse and worse. And I remember Stefan saying at some point, it's beautiful as it is, as it's new, but after 3, 4 laps, he said literally, when I even think about the rear tire, the bike starts already chattering. Okay, that's a bit, but he made his point to me. I never forgot that. We were thinking sometimes we solved it, and then the next day the chatter monster was always back because it comes from every corner except where you look. But in the end, there came another rear tire based on this one without the downside, and nobody talked about chatter at all anymore. So that's how I connected the dots, and it's still an assumption.
Yeah, I mean, one thing Brad Binder does like to use the rear brake, doesn't he, a lot? You know, that was one of the KTM's strong points last year, that they could really use the rear brake to kind of balance the bike, to steer the bike, and to stop the bike, you know. And Binder's one of the few guys who doesn't use a thumb brake or a scooter brake. He's got tiny feet. I mean, he's not that short, but he's got tiny feet. So he can still get to the brake without catching his foot on the ground when he's kind of deep into the corner. So that's pretty weird that what he said. Yeah, something's going on there. And it's sort of really important, obviously, when you're getting into towards the apex of the corner, you're not at high RPM, you're at a very low RPM. And it's a very tricky thing for the engine designers to do. I remember Kurt Treib, the KTM engine designer, telling me that's such a critical point. You're trying to slow the engine down, but you still got to keep it firing at very low RPM. Because if it stops burning, then, you know, if the RPM gets so low and you're restricting the fuel or whatever they're doing through the butterflies, through the throttle butterflies, if the engine stops burning, then it just locks up and you get a corner entry high side, don't you? And you go to the moon. You know, I'd say corner entry high sides are almost worse than corner exit high sides, you know. What do you think, Peter?
Yeah, it's a long time we saw them, but they exist. You're right there in a way that it is one of the hardest points at the moment for the engineers. If you ask any guy who writes strategies for the electronic ECU, what he wants is being able to have a little bit longer the engine brake working into the corner. But like you said, the last couple of meters that you really want it, and it's not now there, means this is the reason the RPM at some point is that low that there isn't not enough negative torque anyway. And at the same time, you have to keep on firing some fuel and some sparks randomly at some of the cylinders, because otherwise you've been running dry for whatever 5, 6, 7 seconds, means when you touch the throttle, nothing's happening.
Yeah.
And that's almost even worse than having not enough engine brake, because when you're balancing the thing on your elbow and on your knee and you just touch the throttle, it has to be really smoothly, really greasy immediately there. And if it hesitates and then comes in one step too hard, you're on your ass. So yeah, and this situation with not enough engine brake on many big bikes on the last couple of degrees of turning in can be solved manually by the talents with the foot, if you can.
Mm.
If you're if you have the talent and the understanding and the practice to do that, that's what they still do. That's what they need to do. On tight right or left hand, really tight over square corners or low RPM, that's what everybody does, because it sort of immediately brings you back to the apex, put your bike on the correct angle when you are at the apex, and so on and so on. So your exit actually becomes beautiful and sort of easy just because you made the right entrance to that apex. So it is very important, and it's an area where everybody's still working in every possible way. They're playing with the inertia of the cranks. They play even with the weights of the clutch baskets in it.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
They try everything at the moment, because that's where you can really gain something still.
Yeah, that's the kind of crucial part of, I would say, of MotoGP at the moment, that kind of corner entry bit, using the rear to kind of slow the bike and turn the bike. And I think that's one reason most riders use thumb brakes, because, you know, if you're in a corner, you know, your hand has a lot better feeling than your foot. You know, there's no doubt about it. Your hand is much better. That's why we eat with our hands. You know, we don't eat with our feet, do we? You know, your hands are just much better. We've evolved into beings where we, you know, that's what makes us special, isn't it? That, you know, opposing thumbs and all that kind of stuff. And so if you're in a corner, deep in a corner, and you're kind of playing with the thumb brake to get that little bit of extra braking or whatever, to me, that's, you've got much better control, much more accurate control with your thumb than you do with your foot. There's just no question to me, Peter.
Well, there is a little question with me, because the riders also want to have the full feedback from the handlebars. And as soon as you need to bring your thumb to the thumb brake, you don't have something around the handlebar. You only have your fingers on one side of it. And that is like a little downside. And so usually riders prefer the foot. The riders that I know about and spoke with, unless and if there is a medical reason, the foot maybe doesn't even is there anymore or whatever, then okay, the scooter brake or the thumb brake.
Yeah.
And also you see many bikes that have both at the same time. At the moment, there is lots of bikes that have thumb brake and foot brake, usually combined in a way that you choose which one you use. And at that moment, you can only use that one. So if you go on the thumb brake, you cannot use the rear brake. The lever doesn't want to move if you put your feet on it, and the other way around. And this is also because you use them.
Can you do one after the other? So you could use the foot in straight line braking and then the thumb going in. Can you do that?
Yeah.
So you can go from the foot to the thumb.
Yeah, but you have to go completely back with your foot in order to do that.
Yeah.
You have to be completely back. You start one action.
Yeah.
You technically close the compensation gate, and then that's it. Then that's the brake you're using. You have to go completely back, and then you can use your... And that's actually what they do.
Right.
The thumb brake also is used on corner exit when you're already using all your... With your foot, you're pushing a lot on the packs. You're playing with the weight over the foot packs where you want to do them. And that's with the ball of your foot. And that's usually when you don't have the best control over your rear brake.
Exactly.
Then you have to replace your foot, and then everything is too late.
Exactly.
So thumb brakes, scooter style brakes, is on corner, and when you run too fast to the ripple steps, or the bike wants to wheelie.
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of...
We have to do one about braking.
No, 100%.
We have to do a whole pot about braking.
100%. Yeah, all right, log that one down. I mean, I know that, you know, from data, a lot of tracks, people are using the rear brake 70% of the lap, aren't they? So they're using it going in, braking into the corner, going around the corner, and they're using it as anti-wheelie coming out of the corner. You know, even though they've got downforce aero and all that kind of stuff, they're still using the rear brake, you know, to stop wheelie. So they're using it to sort of 60-70% of the lap, which is amazing, really, isn't it? I mean, they're using the throttle. They've got the throttle on 100% for 20% of the lap, and they're using the rear brake for 70% of the lap.
Actually,
yeah. Which is just, I find that fucking awesome. You know, it's funny. And while we're talking about this, you know, one of the great mysteries of Qatar was what happened to Marco Bezzecchi, and which feeds straight back into what we've been talking about where you make the difference. And last year, he rode a GP22, and he won. How many races did he win? Three, four? He won quite a few races and was injured a bit. So he was kind of like the star of last year to me.
Finishing third in the championship, eh?
Yeah. Just had a fantastic season. And he's now on a GP23, and he's nowhere. And we were talking to him about this in Qatar, and he said, well, I've lost my strongest point. And I was saying, well, what's that? And he's saying, saying it's because of the engine braking, the way that the engine, the negative torque, the engine braking of the engine, it's not helping him in exactly where we've been talking about, that last bit into the apex of the corner, which is where he, that was his strong point. It was his number one weapon last year, and it's gone now. So he, so, and that was exactly the same problem that Enea Bastianini had with the GP23, because he was in the factory team last year. It took him till Malaysia. Okay, he was injured a bit. Took him until Malaysia, where he won, to sort it out. Like the penultimate race of the year. So it took him a long time. And I said to Bezzecchi, well, have you spoken to Enea about it? And he was like, no. I was like, wow, why not? And then I said, but he said, I've looked at...
They're not friends.
Well, yeah, we'll go into that in a sec. But he said, no, I've been reading a lot of his comments, you know, that he, obviously they log all the comments and everything, and they exactly match mine. And I'm like, well, surely then it must be easy to fix the problem. But obviously every rider is slightly different. But he just said, I hope we fixed the problem before, earlier than Enea did last year. So, you know, suddenly,
yeah,
Bezzecchi, I hope, because I love Bezzecchi, he will be back on it in a few races, I hope. It might take him all year to fix it. This might have screwed his whole year.
Oh, we need him. The fans need him. He's a character.
Yeah, and he kind of doesn't make it, you know, the fact that he hasn't chatted with Enea, what does that tell you? As you said, they're not friends. I mean, they would have chatted if they were friends. And obviously, Bezzecchi is part of VR46. Enea Bastianini is from the same reason. He's from the same region. He's the one guy from that region that has never had anything to do with
VR46.
He's probably closest. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So he just decided he wanted to follow his own road. He didn't want to be part of the gang, yeah, if you like. So there's obviously a bit of needle between Bastianini, maybe not needle, but they obviously don't particularly get on. Otherwise, they would have talked about it. If two riders have got the same problem or had the same problem, they'd sit and talk about it. In fact, they haven't, tells you a lot. And also Bezzecchi, you know, him and Marc Marquez really, really don't like each other. I mean, they had quite a few incidents last year. The most famous one probably was at Valencia, when they collided and Bezzecchi crashed. And it was kind of, you know, when you looked at it first, you thought, well, that was Marquez's fault. But then you saw it from the camera shot above, the helicopter shot above, and you thought, maybe Bezzecchi, Marquez was kind of inside, and
he was wide.
Bezzecchi should have given him some room, but he didn't. And, you know, so it's one of those sort of 50-50 things. But after that, Bezzecchi came to his media debrief with a beer. You know, it was the last race of the year, and he just let loose on Marquez. And you know, one of the things about Marquez is he never says anything against any other rider. It's a really interesting thing. If he gets knocked off, he never says anything bad.
You mean he never speaks bad about what they do on the track? No.
Exactly.
No.
So he can accept. Yeah. So when Martin just fucking ran into him and sent him to the moon during the race at Valencia, he said, he was fighting for the championship. I would have done the same, you know. And I really respect Marquez for that, because most riders take out other riders and say, oh, you know, it wasn't my fault. You know, I'm sorry, whatever. And then they get taken out and they're like, you bastard, this bastard, he's so dangerous. You know what I mean? They're kind of like most of us when we're on the road, you know, you do something bad and you think, well, there's nothing wrong with that. And then somebody does something bad to you and you know, you're kind of getting a bit of road rage. So we need Bezzecchi back because he's a fighter and we need a bit of, you know, action between the riders, you know?
Controversy.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, because there are characters. I mean, shortly, I don't want to make it too long, but that crash in Valencia was such a typical one, because between two alpha guys, that it has to happen. Bezzecchi was wide and he knew at that moment in the race, it's not on lap 13, there will be somebody, but I fucking come back and I'll see what the other guy's going to do. And everybody else except Mark was going to slow down, because Bezzecchi comes back, he comes back. But Marc Marquez said, nope, I'm here and we see who's going down. I have nothing to lose. But now it is on the favor list on both sides what to do. And Mark is quite clever in it, that he says, no problem, I would have done the same, because that gives him the free ticket to do what he wants to do later on. He's thinking about the long run. He hated what Martin did to him, you know? But by smiling and saying, no, it's no problem, because in that situation, I will do the same. He knows I will be in this situation soon, and then there is an excuse. So he's preparing the part. I love both characters. I love both for different reasons.
Exactly. And you know, that's to me how racing should work. It's all about revenge is a dish best served cold, you know? And all these riders, when they get, even if they don't get knocked off, if another rider cuts them up a bit, that's in the brain, and they're going to get them back. You know, it might be be two races away, it might be three races, it might be four races, but they never forget.
They never forget. Elephants.
And they will come back and screw you over, you know? I've spoken to so many riders about that. I mean, there's a whole blog to do about dirty riding, all the tricks that riders do to others that most people will never see because they're very subtle, you know, whether it be brake checking or just moving.
Oh, yeah. It started in 3-1, end of pit lane. It happens all the time and everywhere. And everybody walks around, all these riders, with a list of top 10 of guys rating from fucking idiots to, okay, I have to wake him up a little bit because he's coming too close to me. And it's so easy to say, as soon as you say dirty riding, of course, we all have to say, no, you can't do that. But I think that's not the correct name. It's just marking your place, drawing a line in the sand, you know, let them know who you are. Usually it starts with little things like passing quite close, more than close enough. And it ends with putting people in the grass.
Yeah.
But there's always a couple of moments before you put them in the grass that there were some coming together. There's always a reason. There's always, nobody goes out and puts somebody just on the grass at 200K. You don't do that. Nobody does that. But if you see this happen, there is a story behind it. And that's never an official story. That only these two riders really know why it happened. And they will tell you not.
No, exactly. I wrote a feature about dirty riding, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago. And I was asking quite a few of the current riders, and none of them would say anything. You know. And then I suddenly thought, well, I'm doing this the wrong way. I need to talk to retired riders, not current riders, because no current rider is going to admit to dirty riding. So then I was interviewing, it was after Doohan retired. So I was interviewing Doohan about it. I was interviewing Gardner about it. I was interviewing McKenzie about it. I was interviewing Williams about it. All those sort of guys. Williams wasn't any longer Grand Prix racing. And one of the big words that came out of it was intimidation. You know, you have to intimidate the other guys. You know, you have to get yourself a reputation on the track so that when you're going into a corner and you see a front wheel come up the inside of you, you immediately know who it is by, you know, the color of the fender, the color of the wheel, who's behind you, whatever. And you're like, well, okay, I know this guy, I can lean on him and he'll back out. Or it's, oh, holy shit, if I lean on this guy, he's going to take me out. And literally, so you have to get yourself a reputation as a motherfucker who other people will be scared of you. That's what it's all about, you know. You want other people to be scared of you. And you know, like all commentators say, you know, there's nothing worse to have on your pit board than +0 Marquez, you know, because you know that he's not going to give you an easy ride. He's going to completely destroy you, you know. If it's, I mean, I'm not going to go into, I don't want to start slagging off riders, but yes, some are known to be.
That's another part
exactly,
waiting for us.
Yeah, exactly. Some riders are known to be, you know, more intimidating than others. Let's leave it at that. So, Portimao. Now, Fabio Quartararo has had some great rides on the Yamaha at Portimao. Qatar was a disaster for Yamaha, and, you know, it's a flowing track, which should suit the Yamaha. Okay, it's got a long straight, but, you know, they've had some good rides. I mean, they've won a lot of races in the past, in the old pre-aero era, if you like. But Quartararo's had some brilliant rides at Portimao in the last few years. So this is going to be a real test, I think, for Yamaha. If he's nowhere in Portimao, you're just going to go like, oh my God, you know, they are very, 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 very lost. What do you think, Peter?
I'm already in oh my God territorium for him, for Yamaha, because even Qatar, they had some good results in the past and he was nowhere. There was not one lap that was even remotely good enough or giving you any hope at all. And it was not for the lack of riding. He, when you see him riding, he's giving it all. Not the usual 105% when you're going for a championship, but he was putting enough effort in there to be a lot faster than you turned out to be. He knows his bike. I love it that he still tries and fights even for whatever P10, 11 with Zarco. But it's not where he should be. He's a lot better than that. He knows it. Everybody knows it. But what have we been thinking? I mean, we were very happy that Yamaha got all these concessions. That means they get the opportunity to improve if they work very hard. They bought some really good guy from Ducati, Max Bartolomini. So, but then you can't expect something to happen in one month and not even in 3 months. But if we don't see signs by the middle of the season, really, really positive signs, like crazy aero, completely different layouts and things from the bike, then we might as well forget about it for a longer time, because now all the stars are aligned to start the improving. and we need to see them at some point, but we have to be realistic. You can't see that immediately. No.
The problem is Yamaha trying to hang on to Quartararo. You know, I mean, if you were Fabio Quartararo after that first race,
that's the main job, keeping him interested.
After that first race, yeah, you're going to be, and I know at the first race he was saying all the right stuff, like, oh, I see a lot more work coming. Oh, they're working so hard. But, you know, working hard is great, but if it's not bringing results, there's not much point, is it really? I mean, maybe they will turn it around, but if I was Fabio Quartararo, I would already be looking, you know, we've talked about it before, I would be on the phone to Massimo Rivola at Aprilia, because we've talked about this before. It's our kind of dream scenario, isn't it? Quartararo on the Aprilia. And I'm not knocking Yamaha, but if I was Quartararo, I would be going, holy shit, so when am I going to, you know, when am I, everyone signs so early these days, he's going to be, okay, what race am I going to decide? Okay, I'll stay at Yamaha, or I'm going to go elsewhere. And he can't leave it for more than, what, we've got 21 Grand Prix? He can't leave it more than four or five races, Grand Prix, I wouldn't have thought, which takes us to Le Mans in May or something like that. You know, he's going to have, by then, if there's not sort of signs of decent improvement by then, he can't wait. He's going to have to go and... Because, you know, okay, it might come good in the last few races of the year, but he can't risk that, can he? You know, he's got to go, right, okay, I've got to get out of here.
I don't know. He was very happy with the way they worked now. So at least he saw that the way of working has improved a lot. So they didn't need a five-hour discussion and a meeting and 20,000 emails to change the ride height 2 millimeters. Max goes in there and said, okay, put the whole bike 10 centimeters high. Just see what happens, just to learn. And then put it down 10 centimeters and then make it longer. Then put that arrow on it. So, okay, something's finally happening. Riders love that. They love to go out with a crazy bike if they know why they do it. And so that's what Max is bringing. But the end, Yamaha still has to bring the parts that Fabio and finally Max proposed to them. That's where we need to work on. That's the area. And if that's not coming, then even with 1,000 Maxes in the box, Fabio will lose interest. Yeah. Fabio's manager must be speaking to every man and his dog in the paddock, because negotiations start by showing an interest. Are you interested too? I am a little bit interested. Okay, then we go to stage two and stage three. And that's how they work. But and, yeah,
I mean,
they are everybody's talking to everybody at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, Alice and Vinales are out of contract, I think, at the end of this year. I think I'm right. I'm not very good on contracts, but I think kind of everyone was out of contract at the end of this year. I mean, including Mark.
I think nearly everybody's out of the contract this year, no?
Including Mark Marquez, but he jumped a year early, didn't he? So, everyone. So it's going to be a mad kind of, I'm not a big silly season person, but because, you know, people talk about it and every possibility is possible. You know, you say Quartararo, you know, one week you say Quartararo to Aprilia, the next week you say Quartararo to, you know, VR46, next week you say Quartararo to Honda, and you know what I mean? It's just all nonsense, because everyone lies. The riders lie, that their managers lie, the team managers lie. No one's going to tell you the truth. So, you know, I always think until the people are actually signed, I don't really take a lot of interest in it. But there's so many rides up for grabs. Well, I mean, if you Aprilia and you've got Alice, if he wants to continue, he may want to retire. Vinales, I'm sure, will want to continue, but what would you keep him? And if you've got Quartararo knocking on your door, you're certainly going to make room for him, aren't you? You know, so yeah. Anything else we need to cover? Let's just give another shout out for our Patreon. So yeah, we got Stoner already on there. We got a Rossi interview coming up very soon. You know, it's all for my interview archives. Carlo Pernat, that will be funny. We'll make sure we're drinking, because he does some work for Prosecco Doc, you know, the podium champagne people. So we'll make sure we're drinking Prosecco Doc when we...
He's a test rider,
when we do that interview. And Pernat is great. He basically doesn't care. He doesn't care what he says. You know, he's very old, and
he looks like he doesn't belong in the paddock. That's really cool.
Exactly.
Everybody tried to look like, yeah, I really belong here. I'm here every week, even if they have a 1 day or one hour pass. He walks around like he's lost from the old man house and can't find his way back. And he basically rules half the paddock.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I'm a scruffy bastard, but I make a vague effort to look vaguely smart at races. I mean, okay, still a t-shirt and trousers, but I, you know, cut my hair and what there is of it, and I make sure I look reasonably smart, you know, because you kind of have to in the paddock. You know, everybody looks, you can't look like a tramp, and Carlo, God bless him, he you know, he's always wears, he's got the same old shirt hanging out and black shades on day and night, and cigarettes whenever he's allowed to smoke a cigarette. I mean, when he was when
security must ask for his pass every 5 minutes, because he looks like the usual guy that's accidentally there and
exactly,
doesn't have a pass.
Because he used to manage Andrea Iannone, and which was quite a fraught relationship. I think Pernat didn't get on very well at all with Iannone's dad. But when Iannone was at Aprilia would have they had an ashtray in a little pit lane, you know, Wendy house with all those screens in it. You know, when they sit on the pit wall, and they'd had an ashtray, you know, and it would say Carlo especially Pernat's personal use. It was sort of there. They had his own personal ashtray, so he could sit there and smoke on, you know. So he's got a lot of good stories. I mean,
you're not even allowed to smoke.
Maybe not, but Carlo doesn't really care what he's not allowed to do. He's the oldest guy in the paddock, and I kind of quite like that. Full respect for him. So yeah, that will be coming out soon on my Patreon.
Role model. I see your role model.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I'm not sure if I'll last as long as he has, but anyway. All right, everyone. I think we're done. Peter will be doing a lap of Portimao later in the week. It'll come out on Thursday or maybe Friday morning.
Yeah, maybe in the plane on my way to it.
So he's basically, like he did at Qatar, he's going to take... And we got like 4,000 or 5,000 downloads for your Qatar lap, which was fantastic, you know.
Yeah, unbelievable.
And because, you know, the whole idea, what we're trying to do to the listeners, is to basically explain why things happen and how they happen. And the idea of Peter showing you, basically, he's taking you on a ride, basically, around the lap, is to make you understand. So when you watch the racing and the practice, you can kind of, you actually know what the riders are doing and why they're doing it, because this corner's like that and that corner's like that. I mean, we went briefly into it just earlier about Portimao. Like, you know, you go over that sort of the jump, and then that mega fast left with full g-force at the bottom of a dip, and then you come up over the top there, over a brow, and you can't see anything. All you can see is the horizon of tarmac, but you have to be already teeing up for the next corner. You've got to know exactly where you're going. So it's all those kind of little details that Peter will carry you through later in the week. So
keep going, Matt. No. A couple of corners more and you have start finish.
This
is a big one too. Last corner for start finish is a Yuchi. It's a biggie.
Which reminds me of something we were going to talk about, was top speed at Qatar. We're rewinding a bit here. And you remember...
Yeah, and overtaking in Qatar. We needed to do that, yeah.
Alish going down past the Ducati on the start-finish, and Binder several times, you know, with his two-skin fairing. So you've got lots of fairing on the ground on the corner, but then you've got a narrow bike going down the straight.
He was overtaking Martin every lap again and then didn't do it.
Barely using a draft.
Yeah.
Peter has, so we were like, oh, they're making so much horsepower.
Yeah. No, but, not at all. It better not.
Peter has a theory.
Especially not, no draft, no draft.
But Peter has a theory.
Yeah, it's interesting. The thing is, I always have a theory.
That's your job.
I make it sound plausible. The thing is, with even in Qatar, where there is serious high top speed and a long straight, we don't start Qatar very fast. We call it top speed, but basically it's a point where we have a speed trap during the acceleration. We are still accelerating like hell at that moment. So the guy is accelerating through the gears, and somehow they pass a speed trap from a short speed trap where they measure the speed. So when we say somebody has a high number of top speed, it's just he was a little bit higher in the speed at that point in acceleration. Let me make that clear. So it all starts on the exit of the last corner.
Yeah.
And if that's a relatively slow corner, not like Barcelona, not like Aragon, but like Qatar, it all depends on the first touch of...
Not like Portimao either.
Yeah, the first touch of throttle. If the bike starts to spin just a tiny little bit there, you have to wait for that spin to cool down and come back, which it takes forever, if I understand from the riders, and then your whole drive is lost. When your drive is lost, you might have 50 horsepower more than the other guy, but you're already gone. And it means, funny enough, not that you get immediately overtaken at that moment because you lost a little bit of the drive. You get the penalty, you get the invoice after 200 kilometer per hour. So I remember seeing in the race, Alice overtook the Duke and the Bagnaia in the sprint race, and then they started the start-finish straight, and I'm saying, okay, poor Alice, he's a sitting duck there. No, he's not. Pecco started start-finish straight just behind Alice and didn't even try to get out of his slipstream and force him into a braking error, nothing. He just didn't have enough rear tire to make the exit of that last corner good enough. And then your whole drive is gone, and this also means your top speed's gone. And the other way around, the KTMs found something really good, and Brett didn't want to pass Martin badly enough, because that's so un-Brett to do. He was three times on his inside. on the braking area and still let him go. This means for me, he was having his eyes. He believes so much in the current package and the bikes. He realized, okay, this is that one super year. All the stars seems to be aligned. I don't want to do anything stupid. I'll finish just second today. And that's how I'm going to do it. And maybe by putting pressure on him, you know, if Martin was really, really late, coming from the outside, still make it to the apex of that first corner, that easily, that was limit. And if you go wide in turn one in Qatar, you lose unbelievable amount of time because you're immediately on the dirty part and so on and so on. So he was trying to force him into making a mistake without being dirty. And if not, then not. This for me means Martin, Brett feels very, very strong for this year. But Martin, all respect, was perfectly fine there.
I mean, the interesting thing you said, you're talking about both Bagnaia and Martin lacking corner exit out of the last turn at Qatar. And both of them were complaining about chatter. And it is on throttle chatter they were talking about. And so they were having to modify the way they open the throttle coming out the corner, which presumably means you're not opening it the way you really want to. You know, you want to open it as hard as you can without getting spin. But they were having to sort of mollify the throttle use, I think, from what they were saying to stop the chatter. Which is, that's quite possibly not so much the spin, but it could be the chatter that was slowing them on the exit, because they were not able to open the throttle as hard as they wanted, because that brought the chatter in. Once you get chatter in, you're in big trouble, you know. So this will be very interesting. Michelin have new tires this year, new compounds, not new casings, but stronger compounds, harder compounds, which grip better. So they're kind of, it's a chemistry thing. They've come up with a, you know, they've got a harder compound that will last longer and but grip better. So it will be really interesting to see if that chatter issue translates to Portimao, or whether it was just because Qatar is such a crazy grippy track that was causing the chatter. So that would be a real thing to watch out for once we speak to the riders on Friday afternoon, whether they're still talking about chatter, because I'm sure Ducati will get it ironed out. You know,
it's a long time ago, eh?
Yeah.
You don't speak so much about chatter nowadays. But
everything works in circles, isn't it?
Yeah, the good thing is from chatter, when you have it, you also have grip.
Yeah,
yeah. You have grip. You never have a shit tire and chatter. I mean, poor you, if you have that.
Everything works in circles, isn't it? I mean, nobody's really talked about chatter for 10 years, really. But suddenly everyone was, well, especially Martin and Bagnaia was talking about it. So that's quite an interesting thing. So Ducati have got a bit of an issue there. Okay, they won both races. But, you know, the riders were sort of complaining about something which they don't normally, you know. So, yeah. That will be very interesting.
But if there is one company that I trust to solve it, usually I expect Ducati to solve this quicker than everybody else, just historically looking at it. They have so much manpower, because you can start to do a lot of calculations and then sort of go down the list of probabilities, which one of the frequencies you can enter enough to prevent it becoming a harmony with each other. Because when it's in harmony with each other, different frequencies, that's when the handlebar starts to shake and the rear starts to pump and everything is vibrating crazy. So you have to prevent this harmony. And so which one of the frequencies can you adjust without losing too much performance? There is a lot of frequencies going on in the bike. Can be even the rubbers in the basket of your clutch. It can be anything somewhere.
Exactly.
But if there's one company I trust to do this quickly, it's Ducati.
Yeah, I remember Alex Baumgartel from Kalex, the Kalex designer, who now does a bit of work with Honda. He basically says every part of the motorcycle is a spring. You know, everything is under stress at certain times. You know, even the engine, the forks. I mean, obviously, all the obvious stuff, but also, like you say, like the clutch basket, the cush drive, all these things, they're all under. And if the resonance of the clutch basket starts resonating with the resonance of the, I don't know, the downhangers for the front of the engine or something.
Resonance, that was the word I was looking for. Sorry, guys.
You know what I mean? You get a few of those resonances that start resonating together, and brrr, Colin Edwards used to call it the jackhammer. To give a normal person that hasn't had chatter on a racetrack, he called it the jackhammer. So it can be, you know, the it can be a movement in the tire contact patch of between 1 millimeter and six millimeters. Imagine having your front or rear tire jumping up and down 6 millimeters. I mean, you know, you're either going to have to go very slow or you're going to crash. So chatter is a very big deal in motorbike racing.
Usually you don't need to crash because of chatter, because it starts early enough and it just pushes you wide. You miss the apex by a mile and everything's shaking and vibrating. You think, fuck. Yeah. But yeah, it costs you a lot of time.
Yeah. So that will be really interesting, whether we've still got chatter in Portimao. Right, everyone. I think we're done. Thanks for listening. Go to OxleyBomb.com. Throw some money at us, please. So it keeps going. And Peter will see you on sort of Thursday, Friday with a lap of Portimao, and then we'll be back. We're both down at Portimao together. So that'll be fun. And we'll be back with the full sort of race report kind of analysis on Sunday night. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll see you next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.